That's great. Mm-hmm. You've done this sort of thing before. I saw that by the way you counted.
Well, really, I don't know anything beyond that, so you got me just...
I think you know quite a bit. You're an established author, and I guess you've done some novelizations, and you write this column. I guess the book was adapted from the column that you wrote, huh?
I write a column that's published in a science fiction publication called Locus, and is reprinted by some other writers' organizations, newsletters. I'm probably the most poorly paid syndicated writer in the country because these organizations seldom have a lot of money to pay for their columns. But it's the ignorance of professional writers about their own business is such that I felt that this was something I had to do.
Mm. And that's exactly why I invited you here, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what a literary agent is and what he's supposed to do. So I guess right off the bat, I'll ask you, what is a literary agent?
Well, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what literary agents do. On the one hand, there are people who believe that we simply accept manuscripts with the left hand and send them to publishers with the right. Then we collect checks with the right hand and send them to authors with the left.
You don't?
That represents about 1/1000th of what we do. On the other end of the scale, there are many people who believe that agents do very little else but take 5-hour lunches in expensive restaurants, make deals, scribble huge numbers on tablecloths and napkins, and take summer houses with their profits.
Well, I know that's not true, or you wouldn't be in this rundown studio talking to me right now during the lunch hour.
Well, there, between those two extreme notions about what agents do, there is a very rich, rich form of enterprise. And one of the things that I have written about in Beyond the Bestseller is what else we do besides those things. Literary agents perform a great many functions that most authors, even professional authors, are not always aware of. Some of the things I have done range from babysitting for clients, to taking them to ball games, to bailing them out of jail, to burying them, to attending their weddings, bar mitzvahs, and so forth. I have retrieve their jewelry from hotels where somebody, one of my clients, left jewelry in a safe in England and I had to get it back. So there are just many, many things we do other than the stereotyped idea of chewing on a cigar and pounding our fist on tables and demanding a lot of money from publishers, although I have done that too.
Well, when did the art of the literary agent to begin?
I believe it arose at the end of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century. I have read references to literary agents who represented, I believe, Henry James and Mark Twain, and on into the early. So I think the probably agents in the form that we more or less know them today have existed for about a century.
Why does an author need a literary agent? Why can't he just deliver a manuscript to the publisher himself?
Well, he certainly can do that, and many of them do, in fact.
But Isaac Asimov boasts that he's never had a literary
agent. Yes, and Isaac Asimov is a very smart man. Isaac Asimov decided, told me this personally. I'm not his agent, by the way, but I know him. I've met him on several occasions, and one day he told me that... I said, Isaac, if you had an agent, just think that you could maximize the amount of money that you get from your work. And he said, well, sometimes you maximize the amount of money you get at the expense of a publisher or an editor. And he said, I believe in giving editors and publishers a break. If I do, they will come back. But if my agent were to gouge a publisher for so much money that they lost money on me, then they wouldn't come back and buy my other books. And since Isaac has, at last count, some, how many hundreds of books, over 300, I would guess, books published, he probably was very shrewd in deciding that perhaps you should give your publishers a break, make your editors look good.
Well, does a publisher give more credence to a manuscript submitted by an agent than the publisher would if the author submitted the manuscript directly?
I would say generally yes. When I came into the business in the early 1960s, we were already witnessing the death of what is opprobriously known as the slush pile, that is to say, the department of a publishing company reserved for reviewing submissions from authors who are not represented by agents. Publishers found that it was just too expensive to maintain an editorial staff strictly for the purpose of looking at manuscripts. And I did a little number crunching about slush piles, and I came to the conclusion that in order for a publisher to continue opening its doors to submissions by unagented authors, that it would probably cost them about $500,000 a year. So it's prohibitively expensive, particularly because they seldom acquire good books out of that slush pile. Most of the good books are acquired from agents. They figure, let the agents read the slush for them. That's what one of the things that agents do, is we screen material by new authors and submit what we recommend to publishers. And so it doesn't cost publishers a dime because to read the work of new authors, because that work is being done for them by literary agents. Not all of them. Many of my colleagues will not read the work of new authors unless it is particularly recommended to them by let's say, another published author. But many other literary agents do read new material, and that is a very important source of our popular literature. One of the things I have written about in Beyond the Bestseller is that that I am very concerned that because it is getting harder and harder for new authors to get a publisher or get an agent, that good authors may be becoming an endangered species.
That's scary. You said it's so expensive for publishers to read manuscripts that are not agented. But that's their job to read manuscripts.
Their job is to read manuscripts, but if they can... If they know, let's say, 50 literary agents, if they deal with, let's say, 50, that they have, over the course of many years, learned to rely on their judgment. And so when a literary agent calls them and says, I have something good for them, the chances are better than 50-50 that the agent will have something that is genuinely publishable or close to publishable. I mean, the publisher may say, well, I don't like it as much as you do. But nevertheless, if there are some 50 or 100 agents that have established their credibility with a publisher, then why rely on this vast pile of unsolicited material when you can turn to any one of these agents and know that whatever they submit to you, the chances are better than 50-50, that it will be close to what you're looking for, if not actually what you are looking for.
Well, there are all different kinds of manuscripts and all different kinds of editors. How do you match the right manuscript with the right editor?
Well, for that you need 10 or 15 or 25 years of experience as a literary agent. Our job is to familiarize ourselves with the tastes and special needs of every publisher. We know from lunching with them, talking to them on the phone, reading their catalogs, going to bookstores, and day-to-day dealings with them, plus gossip. We know who's buying what. We know who among the editors has a special taste in science fiction and who loves Westerns and who is in charge of the mystery department. And so over a period of years, we have become adept at focusing on those editors who we know are interested in the kind of stuff that we handle.
Well, thousands of books are published every year, but in hearing you talk, I somehow get the impression that the odds are vastly against an author getting a manuscript published.
They are, and they may even be getting higher. When I started in the publishing business as a literary agent in the early 1960s, and I got, let's say, a novel, a mainstream novel that I liked and thought could and should be published, I would guess I had a choice of about 75 publishers that I could go to. Since that time, there has been a vast consolidation of the publishing business, very much like what has happened in advertising and like what has happened in the banking some of the other industries like the food industry. Publishers have been gobbling each other up. Entertainment complexes and conglomerates have been acquiring publishers, and every time one is acquired, it is consolidated with the rest of a company, and so you may lose one or two publishers every time there is a consolidation. After all, what do we need three hardcover companies owned by the same conglomerate bidding for the same book? Sooner or later, the head of a publishing company is going to say, let's close down two out of the three, get rid of some of the editorial and other personnel, and just call it whatever it is. And so,
and they don't expand their list?
They sometimes expand their list, and sometimes their list remains the same, and in some cases it even shrinks. But from the 75 or so publishers that I once could choose, we are now down to a viable 15 or 20 houses that I think of when I get a good novel and say, now where can I go with that? And that means, of course, that there are fewer and fewer opportunities for new authors.
And yet, I've read that more than 50,000 books are published a year. Every year seems to break the record about more books being published.
More books does not necessarily mean more good books. That's one thing. And second of all, there are not all of those 50,000 books are the kind of literature that that the average reader, let's say the person listening to this program, thinks of when he or she goes to a bookstore. There are technical books and professional books and scientific books and law books and academic books and so forth that are not the sort of literature that most people think of when they say, you know, let's go to the store and buy a book. They're talking about popular fiction and nonfiction. And although those markets are still thriving, my concern is that the system for feeding new good authors into the system is becoming dangerously congested, and we may in coming years see a choking off of the streams that feed the book business, the publishing business, and the literary business.
Well, that's scary. You deal with, I think you said 12 or 15 major publishing houses, but what about some of these regional houses like North Point Press and Halifax?
There are a number of good local and regional publishers, and many agents deal with them. There are many problems with that, however. One is that we don't always know which of those local or regional publishers are financially stable. Those that are financially stable they're not very financially stable. That is, they don't have the kind of money to acquire books that a Random House or a Simon & Schuster or a Doubleday have to acquire books. And therefore, they may be a nice way station for a first-time or second-time author. But as soon as that author begins to build an audience and get good reviews, the chances are that he or she will be snatched away by one of the better-heeled publishers. And so the smaller houses that try to build authors are going to lose them as soon as they begin to mature. So if, therefore, these small regional and local publishers are left to simply publishing first-time novelists or first-time authors, then they're not going to make a lot of money, because first novels just don't make a lot of money. They may get into financial trouble, and if history is any indication, they will eventually be bought up and absorbed into one of the larger conglomerates. And again, you will see some of those, the more successful of those companies, driven out of business or absorbed into the system and spat out, basically. So we are not, although it's a good sign that there are local and thriving local and regional publishers, I'm not necessarily sure that is the salvation of the publishing industry.
And I guess these university presses pay mostly in books.
They pay royalties eventually, but they don't pay anything in advance. And so authors are not most popular. Authors who are interested in making a living don't go to university and academic presses first.
And you wouldn't either as an agent, obviously.
We have from time to time sold books to academic publishers, and ultimately they have done pretty well. But those have always been for very special purposes.
Let's say I'm a first-time novelist, and I live in Toledo, Ohio, and I've been discouraged because I know that publishing houses prefer to work with agents. How do I find an agent?
Well, there are a number of ways that you can find an agent. One of them is to write to one of the organizations of literary agents. There are two major organizations of agents. One is the Society of Authors Representatives, and the other is the Independent Literary Agents Associations. They have lists of agencies, member agencies, that are willing to hear from first-time authors. So that's one way of doing it. I don't have their addresses.
My manuscript is finished. Do I just find the address of one of these agents and mail my manuscript?
I would recommend, and I think most agents feel as I do, that your best bet is to write a letter describing yourself, your book, pitching it, as it were, to the prospective agent, and asking them if it sounds like the sort of thing they would be interested in handling. Many authors write letters simultaneously to many agents because they don't know one from another. They're just names on a list. So that's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is if you know an author, a published author, or someone, or an editor, or someone who's been around the publishing business for a while, you might ask him or her to recommend some agents that have good reputations or who are known for handling the kind of book that you have written. So there are various ways that you can get recommendations of good literary agents for the kind of thing you're writing.
Now, you have a lot of funny stories about your working relationship with writers and with editors. What are writers like? Is it possible to generalize? Some of them seem to be very temperamental. Some seem to be very docile. Are they just like people everywhere, or what?
They are, and they are not. They are in the sense that they have the same bodies as you and I, and those bodies have to be fed, and their needs, physical and financial needs, have got to be taken care of. They live in houses. They pay rent or co-op mortgage money or whatever it is. They need food and clothing like the rest of us. So to that extent, they are just like anyone else in the world. On the other hand, they are creative people. Some of them are artists. Some of them are not artists, but they have artistic temperaments. Many of them live alone, or if they have families, they still work alone, meaning that they kind of go off into a fantasy world to create their work. And so writers tend, like most solitary people or people who work in solitary professions, writers tend to get a little paranoid and a little crazy. And depending on their emotions, some of them get very crazy. And one of the things that agents have to do is deal with various temperaments among authors. I know many authors who are quiet and docile and gentle, civil, and responsible. And I may hear from them two or three times a year when they deliver a book or when they need a check or whatever it may be, and that's the end of it. Then there are other kinds who get paranoid,
you in the middle of the night,
call me in the middle of the night, call their publishers in the middle of the night, call their publishers' names in the middle of the night, and are holy terrors. And sometimes we have to know enough about human nature so that we are, among many things that agents are, we are psychiatrists and handholders. And you have to know which ones are which. A very quiet author is not necessarily a contented author. He or she may be sitting on a volcano, and one day it blows up in your face, and you thought that this author was very happy, and unknown to you, he or she was dwelling on some real or fancied grievance, and finally they come out and tell you or leave you. On the other hand, the authors who blow off steam all the time may be difficult, but they may also be very loyal and wonderful writers. And so just because they're a pain in the neck doesn't necessarily mean that you don't want to represent them.
What happens if this novelist in Toledo, Ohio, sends you his manuscript, you read it, you like it, and you begin sending it around? You can't find anybody to buy it, but you still have confidence in it. How long do you continue to work with this writer?
Well, that's very dependent on the individual property. If there are some books that I love so much that I will vow to circulate it until either it or I drops dead. There is a lot of turnover in publishing houses, editorial turnover, and therefore the editor who rejected your book yesterday may leave the company today and be replaced by somebody, and I may just go right out to that replacement and submit your book all over again. So although there may only be 15 or 20 markets to go to, there is still the possibility that you can go to the same publishing company two or three times, and most agents can report experiences of having sold a book to a publisher that rejected it two or three years ago because a new editor came in with a totally different temperament or policy change at the publishing company. Sometimes they'll call you and say, you know that Western we rejected? Well, we've just started a line of Westerns, and we'd like to have another look at that book that we sent back to you a couple years ago.
Can you go over an editor's head? For example, you submit the manuscript to someone at Simon & Schuster, and he rejects it, and you still have confidence in the manuscript. Can you go over that editor's head and find another editor within the publishing house?
It's a very dangerous tactic. Going over anybody's head in any industry or any service business, as I'm sure you can imagine, is a very dangerous tactic to take. So we don't usually operate that way. If there is a book so big and important that I feel I should go not to an editor or a working editor, let's say, but his superior officer, the editor-in-chief, or the superior officer of the editor-in-chief, namely the publisher himself or herself, if I feel that strong, I will go there to begin with. On the other hand, you have to understand that the higher-ups in publishing are not necessarily people who read books or make editorial decisions. Many of them are involved in the administration of the publishing company and don't always take an active hand in the decisions to acquire books. They will, you know, if I submitted a book to a publisher and said this is a terrific book, the chances are that that publisher might take the manuscript and submit it to an editor and say, what do you think? Give me your report, you know, on Monday, and then I will decide whether our company should get involved in it. So going to that top of the company is not always a great idea or an effective one. More and more publishing companies are run on a committee basis, so that if there is a book that I have submitted to an editor that I'm really high on, I might find a way to campaign among the other editors and executives who sit on the editorial board or the editorial committee of a publishing company. I might call them and say, by the way, Joe down the hall from you is reading a terrific book, and if you have an opportunity, you really ought to have a look at it because it's great. And what we're doing basically is kind of caucusing to line up votes for our project that will be presented at an editorial committee. So the idea that we just call the publisher, send it over to him, and ask him for an offer in the morning is not really an accurate portrayal of the way most agents operate.
Now, beyond the best seller, you have a lot about the economics of publishing and of writing. I guess it would be a surprise to many authors to find out that if they sell a book, the publisher does not send the writer the check.
Well, if an agent sells the book to a publisher, the check is going to go to the agent. The agent is your fiduciary representative. And so the contract will be made between the publisher and you, the author, but it will commit the publisher to send money, statements, contracts, and other things, correspondence, to your agent, who will then forward them on to you, hopefully after the deduction of his commission.
That's right. The agent takes his 10 or 15% first.
Right.
I mean, that is obviously a prudent way to do business, at least as far as the agent is concerned.
That's the only way. That is how we make our living.
I guess if the check went directly to the author, it might at times be hard to collect your percentage, wouldn't it?
Well,
it
would not be a very businesslike way to run a literary agency. So we usually insist that monies be payable to us, and we then take our commission and disperse the net amount to the author. There are occasional exceptions to that, and a desperate author who cannot wait for the processing of a check from the publisher to the author to the agent, from the agent to the author, may ask his agent to make an exception, and then the agent could prevail on the publisher as a favor to send the 90% or the 85%, whatever is the net that the author is expecting after agent's commission, send that directly to the author and send me my commission as a separate check. But we will not generally permit the 100% of the money to be sent to the author, because then we have to dun authors for money, and that puts us in a very awkward position. We are their representatives, so we don't want to be ever to be put in an adversarial relationship with our clients.
You have a chapter about the expenses that are... You have a chapter in Beyond the Bestseller about the expenses often incurred. Photocopying, long-distance calls. I think an author might be surprised to find out that he's going to have to pay for all that.
Well, he doesn't have to pay for all of our expenses, but when you enter into an agreement with the literary agent, there are certain what we call extraordinary expenses that we ask the author to share or to actually pick up. These vary from one agent to another. Some will treat you to photocopy, and others will make you pay for photocopy. Let's say a photocopy. If I run off 8 or 10 copies of your manuscript to auction to a publisher at approximately 10 cents a page. If your book is 500 pages long, that's $50 a copy. And if I run off 10 copies, you're talking about an expense to me of $500. This, most agents consider an expense that we really cannot absorb. And so,
unless you're representing Ludlum.
Well, I can't speak for... I know the agent who represents Ludlum, but I don't know what his policy is about charging Ludlum for those expenses.
I would assume very benign.
Well, I would guess so. But, you know, if you have a policy, then it may not be a good idea to make an exception for a rich author. But agents have their own individual policies on absorbing or not absorbing expenses. Some among the expenses we incur that we often try to ask the author to contribute to are the cost of purchasing copies of the author's books for exploitation of movie and TV and magazine and foreign rights, the cost of running off photocopies of manuscripts and other and documents, messenger costs. If you want your check today instead of a week from now, we might send a messenger to pick it up, and that costs money. The cost of shipping heavy books by airmail overseas is prohibitive, and so you can see that if agents absorbed all of these costs, their profit margin would be cut so low as to make it close to unprofitable for them. And so most agents have some sort of policy about absorption of these extraordinary expenses.
Richard Curtis, how did you get into the literary agenting business? You did not really have a background in publishing as such, did you?
I graduated from college. I knew I wanted to be associated with something having to do with writing. I wanted to be a writer myself. And in due time, I did become a professional writer.
Did you have an agent?
I didn't have an agent, and I don't have an agent. As I half-jokingly say, I don't trust literary agents, maybe because I know what goes on in literary agencies.
What goes on?
I feel...
Tell me, what happens?
Well, manuscripts can occasionally get lost. Checks can get screwed up. You know, we agents run the same kind of businesses as other companies, and occasionally there are delays and mix-ups and things like that. So because I am more sensitive to some of these things than authors who are not also literary agents, I just get very impatient and very nervous and decided that I would rather handle my own stuff. And, of course, that's probably the worst thing you can do, because I have also written a book called How to Be Your Own Literary Agent, and I have discovered as my own literary agent that I have many character traits that don't serve me very well when it comes to representing myself. And as they say in the legal profession, he who represents himself probably has a fool for a client. And so I have probably not maximized exploitation of my own work because I have represented myself. So the moral here is do what I say, not what I do.
Well, back to your origins. So you were set out to be a writer, and
no, I very quickly discovered when I graduated that there were no writing jobs that paid any reasonable sums for an unpublished writer. So I pounded the pavement looking for a publishing job, and the first job that was offered to me was as I guess you would call it, an apprentice at the Scott Meredith Literary Agency, a very distinguished agency. And I worked there for 7 or 8 years learning the trade. I left there eventually to try my hand at freelance writing, and succeeded in many ways, if you call 40 or 50 published books succeeding. But none of them ever achieved the kind of breakout success that I really was hoping for in order to make a good living. And I began I began receiving calls and letters from some authors whom I had previously represented, saying, "Remember me? Well, I've written this book, and would you please handle it for me?" And so, for several years, I was an agent by day and an author by night, and eventually discovered that I was really temperamentally better suited to being an agent than being an author, and also discovered it was more profitable to be an agent. I could make more money, and still can, on one phone call to a publisher on behalf of an author than I can spending 3 or 6 months to write a book on my own.
Well, Richard Curtis, to kind of wrap things up, you have you mentioned that you were a freelancer for a while, but you have some cautionary words for authors. People often dream about opening a little restaurant or maybe an inn in Vermont or their own tavern, a little pub or something like that. But writers, of course, often dream about being a full-time writer, freelance writer, not having to do it on the weekend. But there are a lot of pitfalls, and you have some cautionary words about that.
Well, my advice to most authors is, most would-be authors, is to, start by writing paperbacks. There is a very active market right now, and there has been for many years, in the such genres as Western, science fiction, mysteries, male action, romance, contemporary romantic and historical romantic fiction, occult, horror. There is a very hungry market for that kind of stuff. An author surveying the field, trying to decide what should I write, is better off trying to write that sort of thing, where there is still an open slush pile at many publishing companies for that kind of thing, as well as agents who are very happy to represent that type of author, because they're working in an area that has been established to be a selling area. Rather than writing a great American novel, Moby Dick, right off the bat, and hoping that you are discovered. So I would urge would-be authors to study the paperback market, go to the bookstores, read that stuff, find a genre that they are comfortable with. They may enjoy writing science fiction or romance. Establish themselves with paperback companies. Go to an agent after you've sold one or two books. And then as you plant your roots deeper and deeper at one or two publishing companies, you can begin expanding the sort of thing you do until you move into a more mainstream kind of literature and achieve those dreams that you had originally. But I wouldn't start out trying to write and sell and get published a work of mainstream literature, because you really are pitting yourself against some very high odds.
And you would advise not giving up the day job either?
Not yet. I would say if you have commitments for 1 or 2 years worth of books, if publishers actually have you under contract for 5 or 10 books in advance, a couple of years worth of work, then you can consider giving up your day job. But many authors, as soon as they sold their first 1 or 2 books, have jumped into full-time freelancing and discovered to their dismay that they really weren't either financially or psychologically ready to do that, or creatively.
Well, Richard Curtis, Beyond the Bestseller, really interesting. I learned an awful lot about literary agents that I never knew before. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Hang on a second.